Well, it's officially been 51 days since 2022 began. And that means it's been about 51 days since some of you here started your New Year's resolutions. How's that going? A recent study revealed that only about 80% of people admit to keeping their New Year's resolutions to this time of year. And it hasn't been a problem for me for some time because I just have utterly given up on New Year's resolutions. You can't fail at New Year's resolutions if you don't pick up a New Year's resolution, right? But why is it so hard? Why is it so hard to keep New Year's resolutions? Well, I'm sure that there's some psychology, some science behind why it's so hard to change. And those of you who are followers of Jesus might chalk it up to the good old sin nature that makes us do the things that we don't want to do. But I watched a recent video on YouTube, a news report that came out of St. Louis, and I came to this profound discovery. It's February. February is literally the worst month in the year. And that's what keeps us from accomplishing our New Year's resolutions. The newscaster Kevin Killeen explains this. February is the worst month of the year. But it's an honest month. It's a month that doesn't hold up life any better than it really is. I mean, look around here. Look around downtown on a February day. This looks like a place where people who are punished are sent. It's different than in summer. No one is tap dancing or breaking into a Rodgers and Hammerstein song. It's their lunch hour, and they're just barely able to get across the street and hunker over a bowl of chili. Carbohydrates are big this time of year. Also, lotions, because everybody is itchy and tired and irritable. Even the land is tired in February. Most of the birds who can afford it have gone to Florida. And the trees that once cheered us, they're hard to look at this month. Life is stripped down to the starkness of February. To try to hide the bleakness of February, man invented Valentine's Day and also Mardi Gras. But then February answered back with another holiday, Ash Wednesday. What other month could host a holiday that's designed to remind us that we're all going to die? That's February for you. It's bleak, it's honest, and it just tells you the way that it really is. So the cards are kind of stacked against us because of February. Even when it seems like there's this grand hope on February 2nd that the groundhog is going to emerge and not see a shadow, there's always something strange that comes up, like this year when the groundhog Milltown Mel died just a few days before, ensuring that we were never going to see spring ever again. What a weary time of the year, isn't it? What a weary time of the year. A weariness means to be exhausted of strength, endurance, vigor, or freshness. We become worried when we spend too much time at work, when we're caring for an infant that wakes us up in the middle of the night. We become weary when we go through seasons of disappointment, when we don't see the sun for weeks and weeks out of the year, or when we work at jobs that don't let us out until we can actually see the sun. We experience weariness in all sorts of ways. And when I think of parenting, I think parenting is just a state of constant weariness. Grandparents will remind you of this, won't they? When they look at you and they point to their wrinkles and they say, "You know, I didn't have these before I had you." You know that, right? They'll remind us of that. Well, every year for the past 4 years or so, I've tried to do something special for my wife, Amy, on Valentine's Day. She works at an eye clinic, and about 4 years ago, I gathered some flowers. I stopped by where she worked and made a little bit of a deal about it and dropped them by there. Well, it's gotten harder every year since. 3 years ago, I was carrying a baby and a vase. And 2 years ago, it got really hard. I mean, I'm carrying a baby in a carrier. I got my vase of flowers and a card and probably some candy. And then I'm carrying a toddler, trying to figure out how do I get them from the car into this eye clinic safely without, you know, breaking every piece of eyeglass, all the eyeglasses that are available, without getting them hurt. I mean, it felt like World War III, honestly, last year. It was bad. And I almost abandoned ship this year. I almost just quit. I said, I'm not going to do this. This is crazy because we have another one. How am I possibly going to do this? But I gave it my best shot anyways. I tried to get the kids ready. And when you try to get your kids ready, when you have three and under, it takes like 5 hours. It really takes, it takes like 5 hours to do this. First, you have to find shoes and socks. And as a dad, I don't care if the shoes and socks match. I don't care if they're two left shoes. It's just, you know, we're gonna make it work to the best that we possibly can. But the two older kids, they have to put their shoes and socks on by themselves. They have to. But only one knows how to put their shoes and socks on by themselves. So about 3 hours later, we finally got the shoes and the socks on, and we arrive at the eye clinic to traverse across the parking lot, which is kind of a dangerous affair. So I have the baby carrier in one hand. I have the vase in one hand. I have two flowers for each of the kids so they don't make a fuss about it in each of their right hands. And I say, okay, hold each other's hands so that we can cross the street, cross the parking lot safely. And each one kind of grabs each other's left hand, which is kind of awkward because one of them has to walk backwards. But I'm not really in the mood, so I'm just going to try to roll with it. And we finally make our way inside of the eye clinic. And I'm already thinking, you know, the secretary is going, oh, cute kids. And I already have, you know, my saying. And I said, do you want to see mommy? And I'm like, no, yeah, I got three kids, three and under. I'm sorry. And that's what happened. And we made the deposit. We left. We get back home. And that's my day. You know, that's it. I'm exhausted. It's like it takes everything out of me. It's not just physically tiring. It's soul-wearying kind of activity. So, but we experience weariness in a lot of ways, right? Emotionally, physically. And is it possible that we can even experience weariness in our faith? Perhaps we get tired of just the routine of going to church, or we get frustrated when we pray for a prolonged period of time, but it doesn't seem to produce the results that we're really hoping for. Perhaps we're just tired of serving, and maybe there's some of you here today, or maybe there's some of you who are connecting with us online who've kind of always felt that way about faith, and that's why you've kind of stayed away from it, because you've seen it maybe have some value for other people, but it hasn't seemed to be that practical for you or for where you're at. And is it possible that there are even some people here today who are just feeling tired of faith, feeling tired of being a light to your community and to the people that you live around, or you're tired of serving the community, you're tired of serving in the church, and you don't even realize it? Is it possible that there are some people who are feeling that today? Well, what we're going to talk about is important, because life doesn't always get easier, does it? But the things that make us weary, the things that often make us the most weary, are still important and worth investing in. Otherwise, we just normally stop doing those things. Whether that's investing in our children so that they can become the kind of people that we hope that they'll be, or whether that's investing in our work because we want to make some progress. We want to open up our opportunities for ourselves, or even simply because we believe in and we love the product that we are putting out there. Or we invest in in retirement, believing that it's important to have some savings that we can rely on when that time of life comes. As hard as that is to put away, as hard as it is to do all of those things. Weariness is a part of all of our lives, but when we succumb to weariness, we derail good things. We derail good things. So how can we press on when weariness strikes? How can we press on when weariness strikes? Well, over the past couple of months, we've been in our series, Promised Land, a life in an in-between world. And we've been taking a look at the book of Isaiah. Isaiah was a prophet who lived in the 8th century B.C., 8 centuries before Christ. He was a prophet from Jerusalem. And he prophesied, God spoke to the people through him about some of the difficult times they were going through. Right now, in this current place in history that we find ourselves, a lot of us are watching the news and watching how there's hundreds of thousands of troops in Russia amassing at the Ukraine border. Well, that wasn't all unlike what was happening to Israel back then, which was divided into a northern and a southern kingdom. They found themselves in this conflict between global superpowers that were vying for their land, their allegiance, their wealth, their riches. And so they were facing conflict all the time. When they were walking closely with God as a nation, it provided a special amount of security. The northern nation was not. They went into captivity because of the Assyrian kingdom that came and swept them away. And God protected the southern kingdom, who was walking more in step with God during that time, even though the Assyrians came very close to them as well. But eventually the southern kingdom fell away, and they were taken into exile by the kingdom of Babylon, experiencing all sorts of difficulties and trials during that time. Can you imagine if you went on a trip somewhere and all of a sudden the borders to your country were closed? Living in a land where the language is not your own, the culture is not your own, basically living out of a suitcase for all of your days. Well, we'll take that, and let's take it just a step further, because the Israelites, they were living in a land that mocked them. They were living in a land that they had to depend upon the people that hated them for food and provision and to meet their needs. You can imagine that the Israelites had a lot of questions during this time. How did we get here, God? Why did you allow this to happen? Is there a chance that there is still mercy for us in this place? How is that going to come about? How will that look? Well, that's kind of the setting that we find ourselves in the chapter that we're about to look in. When God burst forth through Isaiah's mouth to tell the Israelites that they would be eventually going back to Jerusalem. And to visit this text, we're gonna do a creative reading from Grace Chapel.
For I am about to create new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered or come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I am creating. For I am about to create Jerusalem as a joy and its people as a delight. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and delight in my people. No more shall the sound of weeping be heard in it, or the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant that lives but a few days, or an old person who does not live out a lifetime. For the one who dies at 100 years will be considered a youth, and the one who falls short of 100 will be considered accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity. For they shall be offspring blessed by the Lord, and their descendants as well. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, but the serpent, its food shall be dust. They shall not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, says the Lord. From Isaiah chapter 65, verses 17 through 25.
The picture that Isaiah gave to the exiles, to those who would find themselves in exile, was a little bit like something out of a fantasy novel. Can you imagine a world where there was no more crying? A world where there was no more crying. Crying is one of the first things that we do when we enter into the world. Crying is something that we continue to do, and it demonstrates that we, even as adults, often in our shame, that we aren't in control of the world, and that sometimes we aren't even in control. We aren't even in control of ourselves. Can you imagine a world where weeping would be wiped from memory? Not many of us can probably relate to the tragedies that they experienced in and out with the infertility rate back then, but many of us here have experienced the deep pain of miscarriage. What would it be if life had truly become unhinged and unhindered? Could that be true? Can you imagine a place where men in their hundreds are skipping up Mount Washington? Wow, what a picture. The people of Jerusalem who would find themselves in exile, they were forced into labor. They were building the homes of the people who kept them captive. They were planting the gardens of people they were planting gardens for other people. So when they heard these words, they resonated. Because now they would experience the freedom of being able to build things for themselves, to be able to pass something on to their children, and to be able to experience security for the future to come. I wonder if they could wrap their imaginations around this picture of an ox and a lion having a meal together where the ox wasn't the main course. Could they picture their children touching the head of a snake like in a petting zoo? This is probably a picture that was almost too good to be true in the 6th century. They probably couldn't have imagined something much better. A picture where joy conquers sadness, where life overpowers death, where needs succumb to plenty, where fear is swallowed up by peace. It's the opposite of weariness. It's a picture of energy, and it's a picture of life. There's just one problem with this. It never happened. Never happened. Well, at least not in that way. I mean, eventually, the people did return to Jerusalem, and they were able to build walls, and they were able to build a temple that was bigger than any temple that had been before it. And great things happened, but there was still sadness. There was still fear and anxiety about the future. Death was still rampant. It didn't happen in the way that we might quite expect when we read Isaiah 65. Now, the thing about prophecy is that most of prophecy in the Bible is foretelling instead of forthtelling. That means it's prophecy is just a message from God to people about something in the present, about his nature, about his expectations, about his grace. But some prophecy is foretelling. It casts a vision for the future. It predicts the future. That might seem pretty simple. Like if we've read a prophecy, we could probably look for the signs and expect that those things are going to be fulfilled just by looking at current events, reading the news, or just kind of being aware of what's going on. But the fulfillment of prophecy in the Bible is a little bit more complex than that. There's actually several kinds of different fulfillment. One of the first kinds of fulfillment of prophecy that we can learn about is direct fulfillment. And that means that the outcome matches the language of the prophecy word for word. Another kind of fulfillment is called precise fulfillment. And precise fulfillment highlights the original language to demonstrate how it connects. It's kind of a type of direct fulfillment, but it places special emphasis on the exact words that were spoken. Another type of prophecy is essential fulfillment, and that focuses more on the big idea than the details. An example of that would be in Acts chapter 21 with the prophet Agabus and what he prophesies to the apostle Paul. And then another type of fulfillment is one of my favorite types of fulfillment. It's we could call it literary fulfillment. And it's a type of fulfillment that uses irony and wordplay. I love this type, and I want to give you a little bit of an example in Judges chapter 9. In Judges chapter 9, God gives a prophetic curse through a man named Jotham to the city of Shechem and the leader Abimelech, who killed the sons of Gideon. Now, just hold with me. Those names might not land, but what happens is this is the prophecy that the prophetic curse that came to Jotham. Let fire come out from Abimelech and consume you, the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo. And let fire come out from you, the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo, and consume Abimelech. So fire comes out of one and consumes one. Fire comes out of the other and consumes the other person or the city. Well, the first part of that prophecy kind of works out as we watch the story unfold how we might expect. Abimelech is chasing after some of the leaders of Shechem. They go up a tower, and he lights fire to the tower. The fire, in a way, came out of him and destroyed the city of Shechem. But the second part doesn't work out quite how we might expect. What happens is Abimelech ends up chasing after another city called Thebes and their leaders, and it chases them up a tower. And just as he's about to light the tower on fire, a woman at the top of the tower takes a stone and drops it on his head. And that's the end of the story. Oh, what's going on here? The prophecy didn't quite work out how we might expect, but there's actually a little bit of irony and wordplay here. When you look at the original language in Hebrew, the word for fire is ish. And in Hebrew, the word for woman is isha. Isha. You can see the irony here. And boy, would it have been a lot more embarrassing to die from a woman in that culture dropping a stone on your head than it would have been to be lit up in flames like a warrior. I don't know, something like that. You know what this tells me, and why I love this kind of thing, is because it tells us that God has a sense of humor. That's something that I can appreciate. But it also, I think, has a lesson for us about the fulfillment of prophecy and what we can expect. It's sometimes hard to forecast and determine how exactly God's going to fulfill prophecy, because he can fulfill it in a variety of ways. Maybe ways that we might not expect. And I'm speculating a little bit here, but perhaps he does that to keep us humble. Or maybe even better, he does that so that we might always keep on guard, so that we might always be ready, so that we can't try to outguess God, if that makes sense. Well, the return from exile wasn't what they imagined. It wasn't what they quite expected, these Israelites. There wasn't joy. There wasn't life. There wasn't plenty. There wasn't peace, as described in Isaiah 65. But this must envision something greater to come, something that's escalated, something that's bigger. Perhaps the promise of life was not just extended, as we see in Isaiah 65, but it was eternal. And maybe the promise of goodness and beauty was not just local in Jerusalem, but it was global. And perhaps that promise was for us as well. is for us as well. When we have something to look forward to, it's easier to get out of bed. Whether that's an adventure, some project that we're working on, or a relationship that brings us joy, it enables us to shake off the weariness and get our feet on the ground. Could the prospect of perfect enable us to press forward when there are children that are fighting in our house, or when our relationship with our spouse doesn't seem to be clicking or doesn't seem to be moving in the right direction, or when things are difficult at work? God gives us the promise of a perfect tomorrow to help us through the weariness of today. God gives us the promise of a perfect tomorrow to help us press through the weariness of today. Now, chances are that's not new for most of you. You've heard that many times. You've had a concept of that. Why then is it still so hard? Why then is it still so hard? You know, for some, it just feels far away. It's easier to hop out of bed when you're going to have breakfast in just a few minutes, or you have an important meeting that's coming up. You know, many of us here who are entering into that stage of life where another year isn't necessarily guaranteed, we think about this more often. But chances are, for those of you who are there, you've also outlived your parents because of the marvels of modern technology and medicine. And we are reminded of the shortness of life when we see somebody that we don't expect, when we lose somebody that we don't expect, when we go to a funeral for somebody that we love. We're reminded of the shortness of life. But you know what? Life, it moves on like a tsunami, doesn't it? And then there's the problem of delayed gratification. We live in a society where we love our food fast. We love our internet fast. We love everything fast. But isn't it true that there are also things that we invest in that we know that we're not going to get a payoff with until later? We go to college. We leave home. We move away, for some of us, to go to college with some abstract idea of some benefit or some door that is going to open up long term. How many people enter into a relationship with their significant other having a full understanding of what marriage is actually going to be? But we drive forward anyways. We press on anyways because of the mysterious promise that lays before us. Now, you look at the stock market on a micro level, on a daily level, and it's up, it's down, it's up and down. But people invest and put away in their IRAs, believing that over time that's going to help support them later in life. Well, college alone can't define us. Marriage can't alone bring us the belonging that we deeply look for. And retirement can't totally secure us from all of the challenges in the future. If the glories of the next world can truly satisfy and meet our needs, perhaps unleashing our imaginations on tomorrow can help us press through when we face those arguments between children, or disappointments with a spouse, or when our paycheck feels just a little short this month. Well, others find it difficult to really conceive of what this life beyond looks like, don't they? And the times over the past few years where I've sat down with people, sometimes by a hospital bed, who have known that they don't have many months and perhaps many weeks to come. You know, one of the questions that comes up is often, what is that life beyond look like? And it's often accompanied with some fear and some trepidation. That's because when something in the future, even as good as it's described as abstract, that newness can be scary, as anything that's new can be scary. Something that I found helpful, just a simple phrase to speak in that's often brought some encouragement is imagine the life beyond is all of the good of this world, all of your favorite experiences, and more, with none of the bad. With none of the bad. Over the centuries, I don't know if it was in the Western world, but we kind of got this picture of the life beyond as this disembodied spirit just kind of floating around. And I'll be honest with you, I've never played the harp, much less a golden harp. I'm sure it's a great experience, but that is nothing like what the Christian picture of the life beyond looks like. It's a bodied experience. Can you imagine what it would be like to not experience pain? For those of you especially who experience pain on a daily basis, struggle with life and various difficulties and challenges. Could you imagine what it would be like not to experience insecurities in your relationships? Fears about whether you're valued, to know that you're loved and you belong in a community. This is the life beyond. Theologians often talk about a phrase to describe the first coming of Jesus and the time between the first coming of Jesus and the time between the second coming of Jesus. They say it's already but not yet. And that can be helpful because we can receive some encouragement knowing that followers of Jesus through the Holy Spirit can experience some of the joy, some of the peace that has not fully arrived. And yet, if we're going to hold those two things together, we have to come to the realization that if something is already and if something is not yet, they must be already and not yet in different ways. When Jesus talks about his kingdom, he's almost exclusively talking about the not yet, the better that's to come. Can that give us hope when life is dragging? We live in brokenness. Sometimes we get ourselves into this mess. Sometimes we get ourselves into the mess we're in. But sometimes the mess is because of the not yet that we find ourselves in. And perhaps that could give us something to look forward to. As hard as it is to imagine, it will be more real. It will be more real than what we know right now. But maybe, and lastly, some of the difficulties we have with this and why it's still so hard is because we just have a hard time picturing ourselves there. And if that's you today, if you've ever felt that way, I just want to say, I get it. I get it. One of the themes that runs throughout the book of Isaiah is the theme of the remnant. And it answers this question. If God is bringing judgment upon the world, how will his promises endure? His promises will endure because of the remnant, which is a group of people that God has chosen, but also in some mysterious way have chosen him, who he will equip to endure. The remnant will be a people that we wouldn't necessarily expect. Probably not going to be a lot of celebrities or people who are powerful in the remnant. It will move contrary to expectation. Some of the phrases that Isaiah uses to talk about the remnant is, he says, they're a pole on a hill. They're a few olives on the top of a tree. And one of my favorite expressions that he uses is, they are the stump of a felled tree. Last year, somebody pointed out that my plants in my office had gone a little bit wild. It was hard to walk by the plant without getting plant tackled. So it kind of stuck with me, and I set about to try to prune it and trim it. And I talked to Linda Sylvester, who does some of our pruning and trimming out in front of the church, and she was unfamiliar with the plant, so she didn't know. And So I went to trusty YouTube, and I found some videos of how to prune this particular plant. But I found out that those videos weren't all that helpful because they were more for a light pruning, and mine needed to be like, I needed almost to start over with this thing. It was all over the place. It was late. I was in my office. I had the trimmers. I tried one. It's like, no, that's not right. I've never done this really before. I tried another. It's like, this isn't helping. So I really just gave up on it, and I just took it all the way to the stump. And I thought, you know what? If it lives, it lives. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I thought I had a picture of this. Unfortunately, I didn't. So I found another picture of just a stump that I had. That'll give you an idea of what it looked like. Yeah, it kind of looked like that. Linda Sylvester came in for a meeting, and I won't forget what she said. She said, "What did you do?" But with a little faithful watering, it became this. It shocked me as much as it would have shocked Linda. I mean, I thought it was gone. And perhaps it's even healthier now than it... Perhaps it's even healthier now than it was before. God will take a people that no one expects, that nobody imagined, and He will do unimaginable things with them. And perhaps He will do unimaginable things with you when you least expect it to. I will never forget the first day of high school football practice. It's seared in my memory, and it was not a positive experience. The last time that I had done anything athletic was in the fifth grade when I went out for a season of basketball and quit after that. So it was really hard. It was hard. It's hard on everybody. But over my seventh and eighth grade year, I had put on a lot of weight, entering into a high school with a lot of new people that I didn't know, and I couldn't finish the first lap. I couldn't finish the first lap. And it wasn't only physically painful, it was deeply embarrassing. And I kept showing up. And day in and day out, I kept on being unable to finish so many of the practices and regimens that our coaches put us through. And that season of my life was really a nightmare because I didn't sleep well because I was so afraid of having to go to practice the next day. I was set through some of my classes in high school, and everything was a fog that first year because of how afraid I was, how people would think about me, of just the physical demands on a body that at that time was not capable of doing the things that other kids my age were doing. It was really tough. But I kept showing up. And that's not because of anything great that I was doing. It was probably more because of the shame of not showing up and how people would have thought about that experience. But what if we were motivated by something even better and more powerful, and so motivated by some prize that was worthwhile at the end? God is not asking us to win every battle. God has promises in place to protect us when we fail. God is just asking us to keep showing up. To keep showing up to our faith community, our faith home, wherever you consider that faith home to be, when you're going through seasons of doubt and you're struggling with your faith. To keep showing up to work on the hard days. To keep showing up for your kids when they're fighting or they don't show the appreciation that would be so helpful and meaningful. To keep showing up for your spouse when love seems to be going one way. God invites us to... God can do something with somebody who shows up. And he is building something for those kind of people too. God gives us the promise of a perfect tomorrow to help us press through the weariness of today. I know that that's hard to imagine right now. Some of you have gone through and are going through some brutal pain and some really challenging disappointments. And I get that. But chances are it's going to feel really small compared next to the glories, the beauty, the security, the belonging that God is preparing for us. We don't remember our own childbirths. We don't remember them. And is it possible that in the same way, we won't remember the pain and the difficulties of the life in this world because of the beauty of the promise of the next? That's a good worth pressing on for. Let me pray. Jesus, it is hard, Lord, it is hard to think about the future when the needs of the present are so pressing, and that can be exhausting, it can be wearying. And Lord, I know that we've all gone through those seasons and we have all faced those challenges, Lord. And chances are there are people right here who find themselves in a particularly wearying season. But you send your Holy Spirit, and we ask, Lord, that through your Holy Spirit you would bring comfort, you would bring peace, you'd bring protection, but most importantly, that you would bring perspective so that we could cling to tomorrow and the hope that we have to tomorrow, which would energize us and give us power for today.